Hello, and welcome back to the Long Distance Love Bombs podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, and my guest today is Zeneca. Zeneca is the founder of Zen Academy and the 333 Club. His mission is to help people navigate the increasingly digital world and to empower as many people as possible. He is an educator. He is a content creator. He is a Twitter influencer in the cryptocurrency and NFT space. But don't worry, if you are listening to this and your red flags are already waving, this is not a podcast about cryptocurrency, although we do touch on that very briefly at the start to just give you a bit of context about the space that Zeneca plays in. What this conversation is about is a very vulnerable chat where Zeneca opens up about his battles with alcohol and gambling addiction. We talk about how he got sober from those things. We talk about mindset and do a little bit of a deep dive into Stoic philosophy, including a discussion around how to navigate risk, how to deal with emotions. We talk about gratitude, and we basically just have a great chat about life. I have a lot of time for Zeneca. He has a big heart. He is a good dude, and he's very open and honest here on this conversation in a way that I haven't seen him communicate publicly. So I think you're going to enjoy the chat. As mentioned at the end, he has a lot of really in-depth articles related to the Web3 crypto space, if you want to get into that. I also mentioned that I took his NFT online program and enjoyed it. I learned a lot. So I'll include links to some of that in the show notes. Of course, none of this is financial advice. Take it or leave it. Do your own research. This is me just having a conversation with somebody that I respect and admire and have learned a lot from. And it's a conversation that I really appreciate. I sent him an email after thanking him for his openness and his honesty and for being so transparent. It's quite difficult to do so if you're a public figure, if you have a lot of followers, if people are going to listen and read the things that you say. It can feel challenging to open your heart in a way that Zeneca has. And so anyway, I'm rambling. Without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Zeneca. All right, brother. We are officially recording a podcast. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Very well. How are you doing?
I'm hot. It's like a heat wave where I'm at. I'm very warm. I'm toasty. But stoked to talk to you. Our worlds have been interacting and sort of revolving around one another for a year or two now. And I know you, and I know that many people in the very niche Web3 crypto community know you. But for those listening that are like, what's a Zeneca? Who is this dude? How do you introduce yourself or describe yourself?
Yeah. It's always a interesting question to answer, like who are you? Who am I? And especially for me, I have multiple names and identities. So my name is Roy, but I have this online brand name that I go with, which is Zeneca, which I created a couple of years ago. And I'll get into that in a minute. But I'm 35 years old. I played professional poker for about 15 years, which is probably one of the most interesting or notable things I think that I've done. So from about 2005 to early 2021, I was a poker player, and I mostly played online, but occasionally traveled, you know, to casinos and played in the World Series in Vegas and bounced around and all that kind of stuff. And then I got into crypto and really just fell in love with the space for a variety of reasons. I found it really interesting and sort of like pushing the boundaries of what's possible with technology and the future of money and culture as well with NFTs and things like that, which I know a lot of people think are a scam, but I think 99% of them are a scam, but like it's in the 1%. And I think that over time that 1% will grow. It's kind of like I refer to it as like the internet in the 90s. But yeah, I've been like a writer in the NFT space and crypto space, creating content. I have a newsletter. I started a couple of companies about 2 years back, which are focused on creating educational content about this whole new crypto space. And that's kind of what I do these days.
Yeah, that's actually how I found you. Is I was on Twitter, and you have a pretty outstanding reputation, at least on Twitter and in this space, as being a good human with a good heart who is mature and respectful, etc. And you,
sorry to interrupt, but it is unfortunate that the bar is so low that being a good human and being mature, it like gives you a great reputation in the space. But it kind of is the case where, unfortunately, I mean, there are a lot of amazing people in the space, but like it's the limelight generally goes to the bad actors. And so, yeah.
Yeah. That's perhaps an episode in itself, isn't it?
Yes.
But you did stand out as being a light amidst some of the chaos that is the burgeoning industry of Web3 and crypto. And I learned that you had an NFT for sale that when you buy it, you can take a course that you made to learn all about NFTs and crypto. And I was like, oh, this is a good idea. I'll just buy this NFT. I'll take this guy's course. And in full transparency, I was like, and then I'll just sell it back.
Yeah.
And life is good. And I did. I took the course and I still have the NFT because I was like, I like this dude. I like what he's putting out. And I like what's happening in the space. I learned a lot. So I wanted to, just for those listening that aren't familiar with, when you say crypto or when we say NFT, could you give a quick like primer as to what exactly that means?
Yeah, so crypto stands for cryptocurrencies, and effectively it is a new form of digital money. It was sort of invented slash created in 2009, if I'm getting my facts correct. And the idea being that, I mean, I can really go down a rabbit hole here, but like at the high level, it's basically a new form of digital money that people can use to sort of, you know, if I want to send money to my family in India or Australia, traditionally you would use something like Western Union, or you'd go, you know, bank. Now there's like wise.com but there's always like transaction fees and currency conversion fees, and it starts to get expensive and can be problematic, especially with certain countries that have less robust banking systems. And crypto basically allows you to send money all around the world in a trustless and purely digital way, which is kind of fun and amazing. And then there's many more use cases that come based on this whole technology, NFTs being one of them, which, I mean, at a high level, it is if crypto, like Bitcoin, most people will have heard of Bitcoin or Ethereum are the two most common cryptocurrencies. And again, you can think of them as like sending money back and forth. NFTs are a way to own things that aren't currencies. So, you know, digital art is a great example. If someone's a digital artist, they create animations or something like that, and they want to sort of sell their work to a collector, like people go out and collect art traditionally, this creates an ecosystem where that can happen in the virtual world.
Yeah, and other use cases potentially will be mortgages, insurance. Mm-hmm. I feel like at some point, everybody's going to own NFTs, whether they know it or not, whether they like it or not.
Yes. An analogy that I like to use is that it will be like the technology that underpins the next generation of the internet. In a similar way to like everyone already owns digital stuff today. Everyone has effectively an email address, right? You have your own email address. You feel like you own it. It's yours, and it runs on all this weird technology under the hood, like HTTPS, TCP/IP, all this, you know, stuff that I don't even know, mail servers and stuff like that. That stuff is basically what NFTs are. And now the use cases that are built on top of it are infinite. And you know, email was one that everyone uses today. There will be a million use cases that come out of it that come out of the NFT technology that we just don't have yet. And I think that's why the world is kind of rightly skeptical of the technology, again, like people were of the internet in the 90s.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I've heard it also described as like, the technology is paper. Have you seen this analogy? And then you can make...
I know money. Who created the analogy. A friend of mine, Swombat. Yeah.
Okay.
He's really great. Yeah.
Do you want to touch on that briefly? Do you remember the crux?
You would probably do a better job of explaining because it's been a while since I've done it. YouTube video.
I was hoping to pass it off for the same reason. But essentially, my recollection is the technology itself of cryptocurrency or NFTs is equivalent to paper. And what you do with that paper is you could fold it and make origami. You could write on it and create money. You can make art. Mm-hmm. You can create a newspaper. You can do all kinds of things that you would never have predicted when the paper itself was invented, right?
Yeah.
You could light it on fire, you can make kindling, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the same idea here. And everybody at this point is like, we made paper. This paper is better. No, this paper is better. I like paper. Paper's exactly. A scam. Why do we need paper? We have stones and sand. And like,
yes,
that's where we're at. Still.
Yes, exactly. 100%. You nailed it.
Okay. So let's go back though, because you are or were a professional poker player. I don't think I've ever talked to one of those individuals in my life. I have lots of questions. How did you get into that? What was that like?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll just start there.
So it was either 2004 or 2005. I was still in high school. And if you remember back then, poker was sort of blowing up. It was on ESPN. Like they were televising it. Like a lot of people around the world were just getting into poker. It was like this craze that's, at least in Australia, like all the pubs that were having like poker nights and people getting together and playing poker. And so I was at a friend's house and we were playing video games, Halo. We had like a Halo night. And then like in the break, we ordered pizza and turned the TV on and like poker is on. And one of my friends starts explaining it to the rest of us because none of us knew what the hell it was. And the game sounded fun and interesting. And so we were like, this seems cool. Let's play. And I don't think we played then that night, but like we set up a time, you know, the following week and played some poker, learned it together. And I'm like an obsessive, I have like an addictive personality, obsessive personality. And I love games. I've been playing cards since I could hold them. I've been playing board games and chess and video games my whole life. And so I just got fully obsessed, went down the rabbit hole, like I ordered a whole bunch of books. I went online, read forums and just consumed poker content as much as I could back then. And then I was like, well, I realized you could actually play for money. I was playing with friends for fun and then online even without money. And, you know, being 17, 18 at the time, it was, you know, I put $50 on and was able to turn that into, you know, a few hundred and then maybe a thousand. And then at that time, I was like, hey, this is actually a real thing and it could be something I pursue and continue. And I had to sort of make that decision between university or continuing to play poker. And I tried university for 6 months, but it was already like I was playing poker in my classes on my laptop and just didn't make sense. So then I said, let me take 6 months off. I'll do some travel. I'll play poker and then potentially come back. And more or less didn't go back. Like I did for a short bit. And then like in 2016, I went back to study law, but that didn't stick either. It's like I've technically dropped out of university 3 times now.
The hat trick. What was it like when you had to talk to your family about like, hey, I'm going to drop out of uni and I'm going to be a professional poker player on the internet. How was that conversation or experience?
Yeah. I mean, my parents are very supportive, but they're also, I'm Indian and, you know, they're both grew up in India and, you know, the doctor, lawyer, engineer, that whole stereotype. It was kind of like that was the hope and that is the direction I was headed. And I was going to go to law school and become a lawyer. But I was just clearly not into it. And so my dad was totally fine with it. He was like, cool, you know, we trust you, go do your thing and you'll figure it out. My mom still wants me to go back and get a degree. So she was less receptive to the idea, but the way I positioned it was, hey, I'm taking 6 months and then I'm going to see her. And then when it came 6 months later, I think they were warmed up to the idea of me not going back. And I'm actually lucky that, so I have two older siblings, an elder brother and sister. My sister is an accountant, married, two kids, perfect Indian child, et cetera. My brother is a professional golfer. So he already went off the beaten track and like loosened. So now for me, it was like, honestly, it was, they were pretty comfortable and supportive. Well, I don't know about comfortable is the right word, but they were definitely supportive of it.
Right. He had like lubricated the wheel, so to speak, or blazed the trail, perhaps another way to say it.
Importantly though, like he had to go to university and get a degree. Like that was like one of the contingencies. Like they were like, you know, to help supporting him in that, they were like, you still need to get a degree just as a backup option, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess it's just like, by the time it got to me, and he's 9 years older as well. So my sister's 13, 9. So there's enough time and the world changed a little bit. And yeah, I just got, and youngest child, I think sometimes gets away with a little more. So all of that combined made it easy for me, I think.
Yeah. And so you are 19, 20, you're making cash on the internet. You're traveling the world. You know, imagine having a great time. Life is good.
And ups and downs.
I imagine, yeah. depending upon the success of your career? Is that primarily the...
Yeah, I mean, like poker, in it, the highs are insanely high, I mean, the lows are insanely low. Like most people don't, especially at that age, but at any age, don't experience making tens of thousands of dollars in a day or a week, and then also losing tens of thousands of dollars in a day or a week. And like that just fluctuation. Plus, like I've struggled with like alcohol and addiction my entire life. And so that just made the entire thing just a chaotic journey for me. I've been sober for like 4.5 years, I should know, but like about 4 years now. So it's been great. But like for that whole journey, playing poker, like gambling and drinking, for it was crazy, but turned out okay at the end.
When you say it was crazy, could you like clarify that a bit? Like just emotionally crazy, or your life was chaotic, or...
Yeah. So I would go through phases. Like there would be like a year or two where like I wasn't drinking much, and I had like a system, and like I would treat poker as a business, and I'd play set hours, and I had like, it was very down to a science. And I was like, all right, things were going great. But then there were times where I'd like basically just go off the loose end a bit, or get burnt out from poker, start drinking too much, but then need to play poker to make some money. And then I wasn't obviously playing good. And then I maybe get into a big hole and then have to like really get my shit together. So I basically just like, I had, again, like really high highs when things were going great and all that kind of stuff. But then I like crashed really far down. I was like, I kept hitting rock bottom. Like, I don't know, every year or two, I'd have the new lowest of my life, and like going through that and then having to pick myself back up, which honestly had prepared me tremendously for crypto. Because at this point, the amount of money I've lost in the last 2 years, like it's ridiculous. Way more money than I made in my entire life before, but it's not crushing me and crumbling me and destroying my soul like it might have if I was 10 years younger, or if I was still drinking alcohol, if I didn't have that experience. So it's like, yeah, it was a bit just chaotic and all over the place.
Okay. So just to add on to that, what lessons have you learned from poker that tie into this idea of losing more money than you've ever made in poker and feeling, let's say, stoic about it, feeling neutral about it? I mean, what's the mindset or the lens through which you view those experiences?
Yeah, I mean, well, you said the magic word, stoic. I found stoicism and stoic philosophy a little bit in like 2011, but like I really got into it in 2016. And that mindset is, it like immediately resonated with me, because stoicism is all about being a rational thinker and not worrying, quote unquote. So like not spending too much time dwelling on the past or fretting about the future, and not worrying about things that are outside of your control. So just like trying to like, you know, be stoic and okay with life as it comes, effectively. And that had always been like a mentality that I was like, hey, this seems like a good way to think, even before I even knew what stoicism was. But when I found out that, hey, people were writing about this 2000 years ago, it just like clicked. And there was this conviction where I was like, oh, there must be something here. This is all right. And then I just like read a whole bunch of books and literature, did the whole obsessive thing again. And since sort of like aligning myself more intricately or intimately with stoicism, I've just felt that basically anything that comes my way in life, I've been able to handle fairly well, all things considered. And yeah, like I think poker definitely led me to that a little bit.
Yeah, I imagine if you were, you probably, or let me just rephrase that. When you were in the poker space and you're having the high highs and the low lows, did you develop somewhat of a similar philosophy to stoicism? And then when you read it, it was like, oh, this is what... Yes. I've been realizing.
Yeah. Gotcha. And some of it was sort of like organic, and like, you know, whether it's personal defense mechanisms or working things out on my own. But I also got like mental game coaching. You know, you have like sports psychologists for other sports, and for mental sports and poker, you have people that train you for how to play well and be better and play your A game and all that kind of stuff. And one of my coaches basically, the thing that I remember that made the largest impact and that resonated with me the most was he kind of taught me how to think about aligning my emotions with my actions and not the outcomes of my actions. So you sit down, play poker for an hour, you play really well. Like you get, you know, you're in the zone, you're playing the best, but because there's an element of luck involved, you can still lose. And so most people will sit down, they play for an hour, they lose, they'll be sad, they'll be unhappy, they'll be frustrated, maybe they got unlucky. And if you know, the reverse is also true, where you can sit down, you can play terribly, but you can win. And people are happy in that case. And he sort of taught me to think about it from, you should try and feel good and happy when you play well, regardless of if you actually make or lose money. And similarly, if you play terribly and you just randomly get lucky, you shouldn't really stroke your ego and feel like, oh, I feel great. You should be able to like look at things objectively and be like, you know what? I wasn't on my A game today. You know, my head wasn't there. Even though I won money, I'm not thrilled with how I played. And so that like objective lens at looking at your life and reality, I think was certainly sort of a precursor to Stoicism and sort of the way I am now.
I love that. I think that's directly applicable to anything in life, really, is,
yep.
You know, maybe you have a hard conversation and it doesn't go the way you wanted. And that could be easy to focus upon. But rather than focusing on, hey, I had that hard conversation and I said what I needed to say, and I'm proud of myself for that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe next time it'll be different. Yeah.
Yep.
But so in terms of mindset, when you look at, just to go back to the losses thing again, because I'm intrigued by that. So
yeah,
you might look at your net worth or, you know, the amount of money you have, and 2 years ago it was bigger and now it's, let's say, a lot smaller. When you see that, when you encounter those facts, or maybe when you lose a poker hand is another way, or we have a setback in life or get a bad email or have to delay a project or whatever, like what is the framework or the thoughts that go through your head from, does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like how do you approach it?
From a couple of different angles. One is just constantly reminding myself of what's truly important in life. And that's generally not money. And so like, as long as I have enough to put food on the table, a roof over me and my partner's head, and like we have enough, which is like, that is all that one really needs to be happy, to find contentment, to be okay in life. We don't need the bigger house. We don't need to travel the world all the time. We don't need to eat at fancy restaurants. Those things bring temporary moments of fleeting joy, perhaps, but they don't lead to anything permanent. And so like just constantly reminding myself and being grateful for what we do have, and that that's what's important. I have a partner, like we have a great relationship. I have a family and I love them and I have great friends. And like, that's to me, like that's what wealth is. And so losing money is, yes, it sucks. It's annoying. You maybe build up ideas of what you might have spent it on and then you didn't. It can feel like a failure because you made quote unquote bad decisions and all that kind of stuff. But just this constant reminder of, you know what, that stuff is actually not important. And I have all the really valuable things. I'm actually really lucky. Even though I've lost all this money, I'm still lucky. So like that is one thing that just helps me stop like going into depression or like spiraling. And I still get sad and depressed and anxious and all that from time to time. But like talking about like this deep-seated multi-month or year-long pit of despair that I may have fell into in the past. Now it's like, okay, just snap out of it almost and just focus on what's really important. And yeah. So, yeah.
Do you have a system or a process for that? Like, do you meditate or journal or punch a boxing class? Or are you like pretty adept at just moving through it quickly?
Yeah, it's fortunate now. It's just like, it's almost like ingrained in my psyche that's just like my default. And I've worked really hard to make that like my default reaction to things, where in the past I would drink, or I would maybe, if I'm in an exercising mood, go for a long run, or I've been through phases where I would meditate. I've been through phases where I journaled, you know, I've tried all of this stuff. But ultimately it's just like training yourself how to think and respond. And like everyone has like default reactions and default sets of emotions and default states. And I think that you can actually slightly alter those over time. And I'm just fortunate that my brain now, when something bad happens, I don't dwell too long on it and can move on. And then the next part is looking at what's in my control, what's not in my control, and what can I do? And so like, again, it's like, well, I can't change the past. I can't go back to 2021 and sell a bunch of assets and now have millions of dollars that I don't and wish I did. That's just impossible. No one can do that. So there's no point expending much at all energy on like that scenario. All I can do is change what happens now. And so then it's like, well, what can I learn from these mistakes, and how can I set myself up to not make them happen in the future, and what can I do moving forward? And so depending on how like proactive I'm feeling and how resourceful and how much I want to actually work on myself and my future and that, I might put a strategy together or think about how I do things differently. Sometimes I just never get to this step and I'm just like, I just get back to that state where I'm grateful for what I have and I go and just do some other work and move on as well.
Reminds me, this is a bit random and hopefully it ties in, but years ago I was in Bali and I was getting my palm read by a mystical witchy woman. And I was chatting with her very briefly about meditation, and because she was so present and she was just different. And I asked her what her meditation practice was. Like, how often do you meditate? And she just smirked and said, always. She's like, I'm meditating right now. I meditated on the moped ride over here. Like, that's just a way of life, in the same way I think that Stoicism or Stoic philosophy is not necessarily something that you would sit down and read for an hour, although that's beneficial, but rather it's something like you described that you attempt to get to. And it's like, no, this is how I live my life. This is who I am. This is what I do. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. The Stoics had a saying, I think Seneca actually, who I direct inspiration, my screen name Seneca, said that, I think it was, it might've been Nietzsche. The only point of philosophy in life is to learn how to live a better life and be a better person. And I think that resonates with me, because today you see a lot of philosophy where it's like people trying to use like, you know, interesting word problems in games and trying to like use big fancy words. And at the end of the day, like at the root of all philosophies is people asking these big questions about life and death and purpose and meaning and what it is to live a better life. And so, it's about a way of living.
And then during your darker periods or the periods of addictions where you were going ups and downs, were you was there ever an intervention from loved ones? Like, how did you decide to turn the corner and get sober or get more sober, however you describe it?
Yeah, there was never like an intervention in the way that you might see in TV shows or movies where like 10 of my loved ones or 5 of them got around and started saying, you have a problem. Like, I knew I had a problem. Like, I remember when I was, honestly, I think 18, maybe 19, I was like, I'm an alcoholic. And it can be crazy then to think that, because then it's like, well, you're just a 19-year-old going out drinking with friends, or okay, maybe you drink at home sometimes, but like, yeah, just all that kind of stuff was like, I'm 19, but I knew then. And so I've always known, and there have definitely been stages where like a partner that I'm with or my sister or someone will sort of step in and show concern for like my well-being and where I'm at, and like want me to get help. And you know, like most bad alcoholics or people who suffer for a longer period of time, you know, I've tried to quit 50 times. I've saw doctors and therapists and did antidepressants. I went to AA and did all of these things. And eventually, either I'm pretty sure most alcoholics, either they die or their life is completely ruined and they lose everything and they're homeless and there's the debt, chronic illnesses etc. Or they find some way to pull themselves out of it. And you have to pull yourself out of it. No one else can ever pull you out of it. You have to do it, figure out whatever it is. And it's different for everyone. And for me, I mean, it was just like, again, I was in one of the lowest points of my life. I was like drinking terribly for like just every day. I would wake up, just drink and then pass out and then do the same again the next day for weeks on end. And repeating that pattern for months and months on end. And it just got to the point where like it became clear to me that yes, either I'm going to die soon or I need to fix. And I'd been in that state before, but I guess this time it was really bad. And then I was like, I read a book, This Naked Mind by Annie Grace, which really clicked for me. It was kind of like, it's kind of like the Stoicism book for alcoholics and addiction. I saw a doctor, I got some new antidepressants. One of the ones helped me sleep. And that was one of the things I struggled with, like not being able to sleep well and staying up all night with like insomnia and anxiety. And so like that kind of stuff. And again, had been on many different types of medication in the past, but like this combination of reading the book and this medication and this mindset just clicked. And fortunately I never really, it just got easier over time. And now I'm again, like let's say 4 years in and
Yeah. And congrats, man. It's a big deal. 4 years
Thank
clean.
You.
Yeah. I don't know if you know this, but my mom, she reminds me is an alcoholic, but in recovery. She just had her 10-year. And so when you were talking about the intervention and the rest of it, like I'm very familiar and I know how hard it is to make that change and to initiate essentially a new life and a new identity. So just want to acknowledge that, man. It's a big deal. Okay. So
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to just double down and agree on like, I'm still an alcoholic where everyone, it's not something you cure. It's like a lifelong thing and you just, you manage it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned going to meetings, reading books, et cetera. Did you like looking back, in the same way that you said when you discovered poker, you went all in, you read the books, did the podcast, was like, I'm going to be good at poker. Did you do something similar with sobriety of like sucking at all the information you could and really going all in on that? Or was it sort of a gradual transition?
I think it was more gradual. Like maybe there were pockets of doing that. But yeah, never quite to that intensity or even close to it. It was try this, try that. One thing about like AA meetings though is, the serenity prayer is it's just straight out of Stoicism as well, which is really funny. It's like, God grant me the, God, I can't remember, courage to, I'm going to look it up.
It's that one that everybody knows. It's like, and the wisdom to tell the difference, right?
Yes.
It's like the,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference, which is literally Stoicism, where it's like, all right, accept what you can't change, things out of your control, courage, change the things you can, and wisdom. And actually, Stoicism has four core pillars, wisdom, justice, temperament, and courage. So like wisdom and courage, there's two of them right there. So when I first, like, again, I'd heard it in my past, but like, it wasn't until I went to a meeting and I'd already been into Stoicism a little bit that I put two and two together. And I was like, that also clicked. And I was like, yeah, this really does make sense.
Yeah. How do you, I'm curious. So this NFT crypto space is often perceived as the Wild West gambling circus. How do you manage your addictive tendencies and your desire to remain stoic throughout? Like, what is that process like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I definitely still find myself making rash decisions based on emotion or hype or all that kind of stuff. I think that happens to most people, but I'm probably a little more susceptible to it because of my addictive personality and background in gambling and very high risk tolerance and all that kind of stuff. For me, it's like finding what I'm focusing on and like bringing it back to like going all in on poker and being addictive about that. Even like within my career in the last 2 years in the crypto space, there've been moments where I was like all in on like trading. And that was like very much like buying and selling and riding the highs and lows, very similar to poker and gambling to an extent, but hopefully with some sort of edge, which is what all trading really is. But then there've been periods of like content creation where I was like really focused on building my newsletter audience or growing my Twitter following, or growing my podcast. And then there were periods of like running a company. And so like when I'm focusing on content or running the company or growing the company, I just don't have the capacity to trade or gamble or like, and obviously like sometimes I'll do a little bit of it, but it's just a different thing. So like for me, it's like, and speaking of addiction, I think everyone in the world basically is addicted to something or has to be addicted to something. And you know, for some it's alcohol, drugs, and smoking. For others it's exercise and meditation even or travel. And for others it's a religion or like it's just like people have these obsessions and these pivotal things in their lives. And so for me it's about finding those that are just good. Like, again, like, it's way better to be addicted to exercise than alcohol, clearly. And you can manage those to varying degrees.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And I find a perspective like that helps me to be more compassionate. This idea of, I heard a quote years ago, something like, don't judge people because they sin differently than you do.
Right. I like that.
And it's like, you go to a airport lounge at 6 a.m. and there's a line around the building at Starbucks, and people need their caffeine drug to start their day. But if you ask those people about addicts or alcoholics or something, they would potentially have a much harsher viewpoint. And so I think this idea that we're all addicted is helpful.
You know, the funny, and this just shows the alcoholic mindset. When you said airport lounge at 6 a.m., I was like, oh yeah, that's a great place to drink. Because in airports, you can drink any time of the day. At 10 a.m., you can go and get a beer or a wine or whatever. Most of the rest of society, the bars aren't open and places won't serve you. But an airport, excellent place for alcoholics.
Yeah, and people are just on different time zones because they're traveling. And it's like, oh, yeah. Where I am, it's 6
no one
PM.
Judges you either. Yeah. It's like, oh, it's you're drinking at 10 a.m., but I just took a flight, and it's like, it feels like it's 10 p.m. for me. So it's whatever. I'm about to hop on a flight and go to sleep. And yeah.
This is an aside, but I was once in an airport bar, and this older gentleman with the big beard pulled up the stool next to me and ordered a Bloody Mary. And I realized it was the guy from ZZ Top. Do you know that band?
I do.
Yeah. Wow. I was like,
that is random.
Yeah, super random. I just remembered. anyway. Okay. I have two directions I'm intrigued to take this conversation now. Maybe it'll be like a choose your own adventure story. One was, I was curious to talk about burnout and how you say no to projects as a founder, creator, etc. And the other direction, I was intrigued about this infinite regret article that you that you wrote about years ago. Or actually, let's say door number three, which is, Zeniga, you can talk about anything that you want, really. if there's a rabbit hole that you want to discuss, if you want to talk about your new organic carrot gardening hobby, like, let's go.
Man, I love gardening, for the record. I got really into it a few years ago.
Door number three, is it?
I mean, to begin with, I'm actually going to go through all, but in reverse order. So gardening was a hobby that I found, I think it was actually shortly after I stopped drinking. It was one of the things that I really dove into, and it's such a great hobby for anyone, I would say. But I think for someone who is, it's almost like you're a baby after you're in recovery, and like the first few weeks after, it's like I would spend days, really just learning how to be a human again. And you know, that's why at like rehab centers, they give people crayons and they're drawing, and it's just like the simple things, and doing arts and crafts and things like you find a sense of like self-worth and purpose and meaning in doing something. And so gardening is like having this living thing that you create and then it grows. I got like, we're living in Munich, and we had like a tiny apartment, but fortunately we had like a modest balcony. And so I just lined, it had so many pots, and God bless my partner, she had dirt everywhere. And it was, but I grew like tons and tons of stuff that we actually ate, and it was fascinating and I loved it, and I definitely want to get back to it. But then when I got into crypto, it just completely, like, I just stopped, and like, that's me again. I went full into this. But anyway, that's gardening. Gardening's great. Everyone should do it. Yeah.
I love the serendipity of me pulling a completely random idea out of the hat. And you're like, oh, I love gardening.
I freaking love it. There's a great quote by Cicero. Basically, it says, all I need is a garden and a library. Or if someone has a garden and a library, they have all that they need in life, or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And I think of that often. Again, bringing it back to like losing a bunch of money, or thinking about like being on the hedonic treadmill and feeling like you need more, more, more. At the end of the day, like, I would be really happy if I had like a house that was my own with a garden that I could grow things to eat, and enough books to read and a library card or whatever it is. Ultimately, that's all I need for extreme happiness. Like, I'm sure I could find contentment with a lot less even, but
can I make a suggestion for you? I have recently, over the last year, taken up what I refer to as kitchen farming, which some refer to as sprouting. And it's just a jar with seeds, and it lives in our dish rack by the sink. And there is something so fulfilling and so rewarding to take seeds from seeds in your cupboard to fresh sprouts in like 4 or 5 days. And it is basically kitchen gardening. You could steal that term, but kitchen farm, I'm in on it, man. I'll send you some resources. I think it's right up your alley, especially if you've got limited space and you're in the desert.
Yes.
Something to consider.
Absolutely. Kitchen gardening. I'm going to look into that. Yeah. Okay. The other two, Infinite Regret. Yeah. I think this one can be quick because it is effectively me. So I wrote this newsletter article on the topic is Infinite Regret. And I was basically taking the concepts of stoicism and the lessons I learned through poker and applying it to trading in specifically the NFT space, but applies to crypto or stock markets or any sort of trading that people do, and how everyone is always living with this sense of infinite regret because they think about, oh, I could have done that better, or I wish I did that. And when it comes to money, it's like, oh, why didn't I, you know, buy more of this stock earlier? Or why didn't I sell when the prices were higher? Or there's just, and it's very easy to get caught up in that. But then the stoic mindset again, and I actually quote that, bringing it back to poker, the mental game thing about aligning your emotions with your actions instead of the outcomes of them in that article. And it just struck a chord with the crypto community because it's been very widely shared and people seem to like it, which I love because I think it's such a, I feel joy at spreading the ideals of stoicism around. So like that to me was really, I feel very happy and proud of that piece, I think.
Yeah. One piece that I loved, that I wrote down is this idea that infinite regret is related to infinite opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
On touching on that.
Yeah. So the idea is, let's say, there's a stock or a crypto coin or something that goes and does 100x, you know, the investment is absolutely amazing and you didn't buy it. Well, that was still an opportunity. And if you like, you were in the space, maybe you had the opportunity to buy it. You could have found like these opportunities are out there. It's just a matter of a numbers game and putting in the work and time to try and avail yourselves of them. Or maybe you apply for a job and you don't get it, but you still had the option to apply. Like there was still that opportunity. And similarly, if it's like, let's say you buy something, it goes up in value by a lot, and then it goes down and you didn't sell. Well, you had the opportunity to sell and you just because you didn't do it, you can learn from that and be in that spot again in the future. Like, and we're just surrounded by all these amazing opportunities all the time, whether it's for career growth or launching a company or an idea or anything, literally anything. And it's just that framing of it's up to us to look at it. Like it's all perception, right? The whole world is perception. So do we look at it with regret and sadness and sorrow and despair, or do we think of it, hey, it's actually a good thing, even though it turned out bad this time around? It could be a positive.
Yeah. And it goes back to that idea of focusing on the actions rather than the outcomes, right? And so from a relationship perspective, if you see somebody at Starbucks or at the gym and you ask them for their phone number or out on a date and they say no, you're sort of in this fork in the road. You could focus on the rejection and I'm unworthy and I'm not good enough, or you could focus on, hey, I'm brave. I took a chance. I went after something that I desired and the outcome didn't go my way, but I'm proud of myself for getting in the game, so to speak.
Yes. And I think a lot of people, including myself, probably for most of my life, who don't have a lot of confidence necessarily, or even like an abundance of confidence, might go away from that and be like, take a chink in their armor, or like have their self-worth lowered, being like, oh, I'm not attractive enough. I'm not funny enough. I didn't say something interesting. My line wasn't good. Maybe I wasn't wearing, my clothes weren't good, all that kind of stuff. And the reality could be, oh, they're married, or they're in a relationship, or they just got out of one, or they're an addict and going through this life stuff and they're not interested in it. There's a million reasons that, and this probably has very little to do with you. Like the reality with things like that is if someone is single and interested in looking to be in a relationship, they're pretty receptive to like someone coming up to them and showing an interest and then, yeah, okay, you can have my number, let's chat. And like, especially in this day and age, like I know people of like whatever age, gender, background, like for my entire life, if someone's wanting to be in a relationship and someone comes up to them and like hits on them, they're going to say yes. Like it's very rare that they'll say no. And so when someone says no, it's usually because of some other reason, nothing to do with you.
Right. And focusing on that action taken rather than the outcome received is great. And you have this other great line in the article, and it's, the best we can do is to make educated guesses over and over again. And I just really was drawn to that as such a simple and profound way to look at life and the learning experiences required to improve and get better and make the most of it.
Yeah. Everything in life is as a probability, a gamble. A gamble is just a bet and a situation that has an outcome that is non-certain. So there's a probability of whatever, winning or losing or some certain outcome. And if you think about it, absolutely everything in life has probability. There's a chance that you, next time you drive, you're going to get into a car accident. But many of us take the risk that, all right, I'm still worth, it's worth taking the risk that 0.001% of the chance I'll get in an accident. And the same goes for asking people out or deciding what to eat, or every decision in life is just a balance of probabilities.
I agree. And I'm curious, how do you make decisions with probabilities of the mind or pulls of the heart or some negotiation of both? Like, how do you go about making decisions when there are infinite options, infinite opportunities available, you can do anything, etc.?
Yeah. I'll be the first to admit, I'm not the best decision maker. Like, I think I default to taking the path of least resistance, or one of the paths of lowest resistance, where like I'm generally against conflict. I don't like friction. I don't like things that don't make sense or that add stress or difficulty in life. And so I might do something that costs more money, even though I know that, oh, I should be saving more and I should be putting it away for a rainy day and I should be more mindful of my money, for a little like less friction. Or I might like let someone take advantage of me, like maybe in a very low, non-significant way, but it's like, oh yeah, I don't care. You can just choose. I don't really care what movie we watch. Or if there's going to be friction, then sure, And if that stuff happens over time, then you need to make changes in your life. But if it's like, if I'm out with a group of friends and they all want to go this way, and I'm like, no, I really want to. No, I'll never do that. It's like, I'll just go with the flow. And so most of my decisions are the path of least resistance. And then I think, when it comes to like the super duper important ones, that's where I really put time and energy in like trying to get those right. Like, what country to live in, and should we move to Dubai where we're living right now and set up a company and all that kind of stuff? When should we move back to Australia? Should we get married? Should we have kids? What should I do with the company? What direction should we hire people? Should we lay people off? All that kind of stuff. Those are big decisions that I'll put a lot of time and energy into. But the vast majority of decisions in life, I just gravitate towards the path of least resistance. Mm.
And then when it comes to saying no to options or opportunities, what is that process like for you? Because I think I just commented on a tweet that you did about saying no and how I had to sort of run in fifth gear or sixth gear until burnout, and then crash and feel sick and then rest and then heal before I learned the importance of saying no and the necessity of it for my own well-being.
Exactly. This ties into the burnout part. And I think because of that whole part of my nature of choosing the path of least resistance and generally being like a people pleaser and wanting to make people happy and say yes to things, that path of least resistance for saying yes to when people ask me for things served me well for 30 years of my life, because very few people ask me for stuff. Just as a poker player, I wasn't working for a company. I didn't have like a following on Twitter. People didn't reach out and want my time. And so sure, one person a month wants to hop on a call, or it was even less than that, I'd be like, sure, yeah, this sounds great. I felt good. Like, oh, my people are in demand for me and my time. Someone wants something from me. I'm happy to have that conversation and all that kind of stuff. When it came to like the last 2 years of my life, getting into crypto, being a content creator, growing a large audience and following, and then running a company and advising and all that kind of stuff, all of a sudden it was like from 0 to 100 in the matter of a few months, where everyone just wanted to hop on a call with me and have 5 minutes of my time and send me an email and have me read a DM and all that kind of stuff. And so like I did what I always do, which is I was like, yeah, let's do it. Like happy to do this. And I was literally working 16, 18 hours a day for like probably 4 months, I think, towards the end of 2021. That's when it was really bad. 2022 as a whole was also kind of bad. Actually, end of 2022 was awful as well. But it was this like, let's say a whole year, end of 2021 to end of 2022, where I was just like saying yes to way too much stuff. And I didn't realize it until I took like a full break at the end of 2022, like a week and a half off Christmas, New Year's. And I just like rested and like reflected. And I was like, oh, I'm really burned out. Like I was just not performing well. There were times where I would like have meetings till like 2 a.m. sleep and then have a call at 4 a.m. that I'd wake up for, then sleep. And then at 6:30, have another call. I was like, at the time I was like, yeah, let's do it. I'm being productive. I'm working. And then in hindsight, it was like, it's so obvious now just talking about it. That's a terrible thing to do for all involved. And so now I've just gotten infinitely better at just saying no and being protective of my calendar. And like, you know, most, again, like it's so much nicer to live without a calendar that's full of things all day, every day. Obviously it's important to have certain things and you want to meet people and engage and stuff like that. But it's my default is very much say no, say no, say no, and then occasionally say yes. Now,
reminds me of this quote from Austin Kleon, who wrote a couple really good books. Steal Like an Artist was one, but he says something like, say yes until you can afford to say no.
Yeah, I like
that.
It's
a really simple idea, which I think is difficult when you're coming up and you're trying to grow and build and connect. It's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds great. I want to do that. And there's exciting opportunities and you sincerely do want to do all of those things. It's like, hey, want to consult on this exciting new project? Yes, I do. But then eventually when you step away and look back, it's like, oh, dang, I was spread way too thin. The other idea was, it's not coming to me, but there was another part of that that my brain will remember in a few minutes, likely. Dang, it's gone. It's gone, Zeneca. it ties into what you described previously about the suffering and like choosing different kinds of suffering. Like, yeah, it sucks to say no to somebody, but it also sucks to be burnt out and living nonstop and waking up at 2 in the middle of the night to have conversation. Yeah. So it's like choosing a healthier form of pain, I suppose, or regret.
Yeah. Yeah. Like we all have to, ultimately it's like, again, decisions and weighted probabilities and all that kind of stuff. Acknowledging that saying no might mean you miss out on an opportunity. It might mean that you might make less money or you miss out on making money. But if it's what it will probably do is it'll give you healthier balance in your life. It might make you healthier and live longer and feel happier and more content. And so it's like just acknowledging what's important in your life. And like there have certainly been phases in my life and I'm sure everyone goes through it where it's like, you need to make money. Maybe you've gotten in debt and in a bad situation or you're living paycheck to paycheck or whatever. Like as a poker player, there are times I was in debt and owed people money, like, and I needed to make money and it was all that kind of stuff. And not bad people, just friends that gave me a few $1,000s too when I was in a bad spot really early on. But that's when it's like, all right, I'm gonna just really just hustle for a few weeks or say yes to a whole bunch of opportunities and work hard and secure a bunch of jobs. And then when I'm in a better spot, then I can start saying no and take a bit of a breather. So I totally acknowledge that there are times in life where you just need to just basically almost burn yourself out and hope that you can just recover and then find balance later on.
Yeah, the channel the David Goggins moments of like, okay, I got to carry these logs in the middle of the night. That's not forever. It's temporary. And then what are you working on now? Like what excites you at the moment? Is there anything that lights you up that you're moving towards?
Yeah, so I'm really getting back to creating content again. That's the thing that I love the most. And I, you know, this is another lesson I learned, you know, running a company where I tried doing all these, I said yes to too many things and tried doing all these things and I tried wearing all these hats. And I realized I'm not good at being a CEO. I'm not good at managing a team. I don't have the experience. I haven't done it before. I can learn, and I have been learning, and I think I've done an okay job for the most part. But there's people way better than me, and like, it's not something I enjoy doing particularly either. Whereas I think I'm good at writing, and I like writing, and like, now that I've done all these things, I know what I'm not good at, and I know what I like to do, and I think I'm good at. So I should just focus more of my time on that. And so I'm excited by like writing more, creating courses. I love educating. I love creating content. So like, you know, I'm working on a course on building a personal brand. I think it's something that more and more people are interested in, especially in like, we live in the creator economy world, and it's getting more so, like the Mr. Beast world that I like to call it, where everyone can now with like X monetizing their content and people having newsletters, it's this really important thing to have a nice personal brand. And a personal brand doesn't have to mean you have a lot of followers. It's kind of like just your reputation, and what people think of you. And so I'm excited by that and working on that. And also tying it into like my communities in Web3 and the companies that I've already built. And I think there's some fun ways we can make it all work together in a nice little ecosystem.
Yeah. I'm intrigued to see that. I was talking with somebody a couple of days ago about this same idea, which is, you know, nowadays you are the brand, like I am my brand, and Zeneca, you are your brand. And as individuals, it's almost like our identities and our personalities more than ever before, our actions, the things we say online, the things we don't say online reflect our business. And in some regard, I've also talked about this idea that personal development is also business development. So the more work you do on yourself, the more you grow, the more skills you have, the more knowledge, etc., that directly contributes to your business because they're aligned. They're almost inseparable nowadays for many of us. So good for you. Yeah. Stoked to check it out. Stoked to take the course at some point, learn some stuff.
Yeah. I'm excited for it. And that concept of like, you are your business, it's certainly extremely relevant now, but I feel like it's been happening for decades where like, Apple and Steve Jobs, like that's so much of Apple and the success of it and what people think of it is Steve Jobs. And similarly, like, love him or hate him, Elon and Tesla and SpaceX and Twitter is like, would these companies be as successful if he wasn't out there and doing all, like, it's interesting to think about. And yeah.
Yeah. I think in many ways, we're getting back to what used to be. We're almost coming full circle, right? Where in the 40s and 50s and 60s, small town vibe. You knew everybody in the town. Mm. You knew the tire guy was nice. You knew the ice cream guy was a little grumpy, but if you go to that ice cream guy, he's a good guy. Yeah. And everybody knew everybody's business, right? And then there was a couple decades where the world expanded and we had access to some information, but it took a few days or you had to search for it. Whereas now it's instantaneous. It's global. Reputations can be built or destroyed immediately. Yeah. And it is sort of coming back to this idea of just reputation, right? Of how I started this conversation of like, you have a reputation as a good man. You have a good heart. People like you. And that is, I think, core to your business model. It seems to pervade your community, the energy, the vibe, the standards, et cetera. Maybe you could introduce a little bit about what you do and where people can find you. I know it's in the middle of the night where you're at and you need to get to bed. At some point.
It's totally fine. Yeah. So people can find me. Twitter is probably the best place at the moment. It's just at Zeneca, Z-E-N-E-C-A. I also have a website that is currently doing a makeover. So the new version should be out soon, but it's Zeneca.xyz. And that has like, or at least it will soon have like about me, a little bit of a bio, and like some of my courses. This personal branding course will come out on there. Some free guides and resources for people, and that kind of like just a basic website type thing. And my newsletter as well, like a big thing. But you can find that from just go to my Twitter or my website, you'll very easily be able to find my newsletter. Again, it's kind of like, I'm going through this huge period of change. I'm like moving from Substack to Beehive, but then changing the domain, and everything is in flux right now. It's all up in the air, but those two places.
And I will, to those listening, I'll put a link to that Infinite Regret article in the show notes, because I think that one is worth reading at minimum. And you do, you have a ton of content. It's very digestible. It taught me a lot about NFTs. You're personable, you're knowledgeable, and you have a unique writing voice, which I think is a lot more difficult than people realize to develop. And it's like, when you're reading some of your stuff, it feels like you writing it. And that perhaps is an odd comment, but I mean that in a complimentary manner.
Oh, I very much appreciate it. I take it very much as a compliment and appreciate it.
Yeah. Cool, man. Well, I appreciate you. Thanks for being here. I know that you have lots of infinite opportunities. So you saying yes to this after all we've discussed is meaningful. And it was great to see you again, man.
Likewise. No, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So that was Zeneca. And I'm just remembering another conversation that may be of interest to you if you are curious about the crypto or NFT space, is that I had my buddy Jason on the podcast, well, twice, but the most recent one was at the end of 2021, episode number 152. And we talked about what's the deal with NFTs and cryptocurrency. If you know nothing about that space, if you are curious to learn a little bit more, that's a good starting point. It was basically two knucklehead friends sharing what they've learned thus far about this radical and innovative new space that is fundamentally shifting the economy, creativity, art, everything. So yeah, and as mentioned, I've included links in the show notes to various ways that you can interact with Zeneca more. You can check out his courses, you can read his articles, you can follow him on Twitter, ask him questions. It's all there. Check it out below. And thank you for being here. Thank you for the 5-star reviews. Thank you for subscribing to the podcast to make sure you don't miss future episodes. And most importantly, thank you for sharing this with people that you care about, people that you think would benefit from this conversation. That is the purpose of all the work that I do. I'm trying to make kindness cool. I'm trying to make the world better than it was yesterday. And you support that and you help that. So thank you. I'm very grateful. And I will talk to you soon.